This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, August 1st, 2002. I'm Deepa Fernandez. The United Nations releases its findings on what they say happened in the Jenin refugee camp. It's day two for the Senate hearings into Bush's plan for war on Iraq. And in Bolivia, is the US again thwarting democracy with a new president about to be announced? But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Two former top executives of bankrupt telecommunications firm WorldCom surrendered to federal authorities in Manhattan this morning to face federal charges for their role in the nearly $4 billion accounting scandal that has shaken the nation's economy. Jeff Brady reports from New York.
WorldCom's former chief financial officer Scott Sullivan and former controller David Myers turned themselves in to the FBI this morning in Manhattan. The two men were dismissed from WorldCom in June after the company admitted to falsely accounting for $3.8 billion in expenses. Sullivan admitted today to investigators he knowingly shifted the money from expense accounts into the company's capital account. Myers also admitted he was aware of the transfer in expenses. This illegal accounting practice allowed executives to report profits while the company was actually losing money. WorldCom, which owns MCI, filed for the largest bankruptcy in U.S. history in late July. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jeff Brady in New York.
President Bush's prized trade promotion authority called Fast Track is expected to be passed by the Senate today. Garrett Schweitzer reports from Capitol Hill.
If the Senate passes fast-track legislation, Congress would not be able to amend trade pacts before voting on them. Democrat Fritz Hollings of South Carolina argued passionately today on the Senate floor that foreign trade is constitutionally the domain of the United States Congress.
The Congress, not the President, not the Supreme Court, but the Congress of the United States shall regulate foreign trade.
The bill passed the House and is likely to now pass the Senate because congressional leaders added provisions to protect regional industries and thereby gain the votes of their congressional representatives. Senator Paul Wellstone questioned whether human rights, consumer rights, American workers, and environmental interests would be respected if Congress is denied the right to amend trade legislation. On Capitol Hill for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gareth Schweitzer.
The trial of four high-ranking military leaders in Venezuela has drawn volatile crowds in front of the Supreme Court building in Caracas. The court is considering if it should order the men to stand trial for their alleged involvement in the failed coup attempt against President Hugo Chavez in April of this year. Yesterday, one magistrate wrote a draft order for the officers to be indicted, but the court rejected that proposal, appointed another magistrate, and said a decision would be forthcoming on Monday. Police used tear gas and fired shots in the air, separating protesters supporting the officers from those who support Chavez. At least five people were injured and several others arrested. Many fear the trial could lead to an outraged military squaring off against officials in the already tenuous Venezuelan government. And people in India protested a Coca-Cola factory because they claim the U.S.-owned corporation is overpumping their drinking water and polluting the rest. Vinod K. Jose reports from New Delhi.
More than 2,000 irate protesters, consisting mostly of indigenous people and Dalits, gathered at the gates of the Hindustan Coca-Cola factory in Plachimada of Palakkad district in southern state of Kerala. They were protesting against the Coke's indiscriminate mining of groundwater, resulting in the drying up of many wells and contaminating the remainder. Coke has been drawing 1.5 million liters per day from the common groundwater resource. To date, the government has taken no action to check groundwater depletion by Coke in the region. On the other hand, police had arrested several villagers on the first day of the strike. They say that Coke will have to pay for restoring the damaged groundwater aquifers and should leave the district. From New Delhi in India, this is Vinod K. Jose for Free Speech Radio News.
Millions of children go without health insurance, even though they may be eligible for federally sponsored state programs. Monica Lopez has the story from KPFK in Los Angeles.
Nearly 5 million U.S. children are needlessly uninsured. That's according to new data compiled by the Urban Institute. Much of this coverage is available through Medicaid and the State Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP. Established in 1997, CHIP gives money to states to provide health coverage to uninsured kids. In California, over 1.5 million children lack health insurance, and well over 1 million are eligible for programs like CHIP but aren't enrolled. The most recent census statistics say 25% of Latino children and well over 13% of African American children nationwide don't have health insurance. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Monica Lopez in Los Angeles.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
In the second day of Capitol Hill hearings on Iraq, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee heard testimony on what the U.S. role would be, quote, the day after a U.S. attack on Saddam Hussein's regime. But critics of the process say Congress isn't asking the fundamental question, why attack Iraq in the first place? Joshua Chaffin reports from Capitol Hill.
At the opening of this morning's hearing, Democrat Christopher Dodd said the Senate Foreign Relations Committee now agrees Saddam Hussein's forces should not be underestimated, that an attempt to oust Hussein would be, quote, extremely difficult without the support of the international community, and that efforts to keep containing Hussein might be the more popular idea among U.S. allies. Committee Chair Democrat Joseph Biden introduced today's hearing.
We want a better understanding of what it would take to secure Iraq and rebuild it economically and politically. I don't mean all by ourselves, but that may be the position we put ourselves in. We need to know how many U.S. forces will be required to stay, how long, and for what purpose.
According to an estimate from one military analyst the senators heard today, if the United States were to attack Iraq and succeed in toppling Saddam Hussein, it would need to deploy a post-invasion force on the ground of 75,000 troops to keep the peace, at an estimated cost to taxpayers of $16.2 billion a year. For some comparison, that's more than the federal government spends on welfare and more than three times the budget of the Chicago Unified School District. Then there's the question of how long those American troops would have to remain in Iraq. Retired professor at the National Defense University, Dr. Phoebe Marr, told the senators it would be important for the U.S. to establish its presence after the invasion.
So at the outside, we're there for how long?
Oh, I don't know. I would guess a good, with a very reduced skeletal force, you know, you've turned over your responsibility to the military. Remember, we don't have to train these people. I mean, we have to redirect them. But this is not Afghanistan. 2 years.
But other estimates run much higher. Retired Army Colonel Scott Feel told the committee the U.S. might have to remain in Iraq for as long as 10 years to ensure stability. The Education for Peace in Iraq committee says even that's a conservative estimate.
The real question is not how many years, but what is the U.S. doing there?
Phyllis Bennis with the Institute for Policy Studies.
If we're serious about looking at consequences, and I think, of course, we should be, the consequences are very severe. We're talking not only about an extraordinarily high rate of casualties among U.S. soldiers, because after all, these are going to be people not happy about a U.S. invasion of their country. Then there's the question of Iraqi casualties. Human beings, parents, children, old people, trying to live their lives. They're the ones that will be slaughtered if we're talking about a massive air assault on Baghdad. It would be the equivalent of a massive air assault on Los Angeles.
Bennis was not asked to testify before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, though Minnesota Democrat Paul Wellstone did submit her testimony for the record. Another expert on Iraq who was not asked to testify was former U.N. Assistant Secretary General Hans von Sponeck, who headed the U.N. Oil for Food program until he resigned 2 years ago in protest over U.S. sanctions. Von Sponeck says the Senate committee is not hearing voices of dissent on U.S.-Iraq policy and that the White House is pressing for renewed attacks in spite of popular opinion.
There is, to me, as a foreigner, a frightening disconnect between what I hear on the streets, where I am right now in Chicago or Milwaukee or Madison, in public groups, in churches, in local newspapers, and the political decision-making in Washington. I mean, this is not democracy.
Josh Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Capitol Hill.
After being denied access to the site of the Jenin refugee camp by the Israeli government to complete an official fact-finding mission, the United Nations today released its long-awaited report on what occurred back in April of this year when many deaths and tremendous destruction was wreaked on Jenin. And as Susan Wood reports from the United Nations, the report discounts the Palestinian claims that a massacre occurred, saying there were deaths on both sides and blaming both sides.
The report says 497 Palestinians were killed and 1,447 wounded during two waves of Israeli incursions into Palestinian-controlled territory from March 1st to May 7th. It cites a death toll of 52 Palestinians during the 10-day siege of the Jenin refugee camp, a figure used by Israel and a hospital in Jenin, but says it's not clear how many of the dead were civilians. Palestinians have charged a massacre took place of as many as 500 of the camp's 14,000 residents. The report says those allegations have not been substantiated in light of the evidence, but an unnamed senior UN official said at a briefing this morning that just because the word massacre isn't used in the report doesn't mean such an incident didn't occur. And a European Union statement attached to the report says the number of Palestinian fatalities could increase when the rubble of hundreds of destroyed houses is removed. In May, the UN General Assembly asked Secretary General Kofi Annan to prepare the report after Israel refused to cooperate with a fact-finding team authorized by the Security Council, and the U.S. made it clear it would veto any resolution censuring Israel for its failure to cooperate. In the report, Annan writes that a full assessment could not have been made without a visit to the area, but says he's confident the report fairly represents what he terms a complex reality. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
At the time of the Israeli incursion into Jenin, international peace activist Kristen Schur was in the area documenting the fallout from Israel's attack.
If he says that, if you have seen the situation in the refugee camp, your tears will be blood instead of tears.
This Palestinian man had been arrested and beaten in April when Israeli soldiers invaded Jenin refugee camp. The UN released a report today on the carnage of Jenin. It came out despite Israel's successful attempt to keep the UN Fact-Finding Commission away from the camp, in violation of UN Resolution 1405. Kofi Annan writes that the report is a fair representation of a complex reality, all the while stating that because Israel refused to cooperate and allow the Fact-Finding Commission into the camp, their sources are journalists, humanitarian groups, and Israeli soldiers. The UN report states that Red Cross and Red Crescent ambulances were attacked and prevented from reaching the camp or helping the wounded, but underreports how systematic and frequently the Israeli military targets Palestinian medical workers.
They use them as a human shield. They managed to enter the camp. They were very close beside the casualties and one dead. And the soldiers didn't allow them to help anyone. As for the distance between the Jenin's hospital and the camp, about 200 meters. There were martyrs in the streets. The casualties, the wounded men and women, they were not. They didn't allow them to help anyone. There were wounded children, men, women, young men. It was a very dangerous casualty.
The UN report also states that 4,000 Palestinians became homeless inside the camp, and 160 buildings, which are mostly houses, are completely destroyed. 100 are partially destroyed. The rubble I walked through in April was 3 stories high. There was no electricity or water. Water tanks were littered with Israeli bullet holes. The infrastructure is continuously targeted. The report states that Palestinians were deprived of food, water, and electricity and were kept under curfew for 13 consecutive days. Many families I spoke with were trapped inside their houses. Many others were taken by Israeli soldiers, some put in detention at Salem checkpoint.
There was a girl with them, and they ordered the girl to take off her clothes. When she refused, she has a children with her. When she refused, they ordered her to stand under the sun. It was a sunny day. There was a man carrying his children. Then the soldier told the man to throw his children and to come by himself, alone, without his children.
Missiles fired from the sky hit, as the report states, indiscriminately. Many children, those who were not killed or wounded by explosives during and after the invasion were detained.
Point, there were many children. Her age is between 10 to 16.
Also from 16 to 45. All of them were arrested in Salem checkpoint.
Without observers, the question remains in the report, how many actually died? The Palestinians complied with and welcomed the idea of the UN fact-finding commission. They say 100s were killed. The Israeli government did not comply. They say that 55 Palestinians were killed. The UN report concludes, based on the number of bodies found, that there are about 55 dead. But, Anon writes, in any case, a figure is very difficult to estimate. Inside Jenin refugee camp today, reinvaded and still under rubble, many Palestinians say a massacre did take place. But most are disgusted with the findings, which they tell me is another case of the U.S. dictating what the U.N. says and does. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kristen Scher reporting from New York City.
As two former WorldCom executives surrendered this morning to face federal charges related to a multi-billion dollar accounting fraud at the bankrupt telecommunications giant, the state of California says it will no longer invest its $45 billion investment pool into expatriate corporations. These corporations, whose operations remain within the U.S., open offshore offices that they claim to be their headquarters, thus avoiding taxes and skirting investor protections. On Capitol Hill, similar legislation to close this tax loophole has stalled in committee. Mitch Jeserich reports.
American-based companies such as Tyco and Stanley Works have been blacklisted by the California Treasurer, Phil Angelides. Angelides says he won't invest any of the state's $45 billion into 21 companies that in name only open up their headquarters overseas, mostly in Bermuda and the Cayman Islands, so to avoid paying U.S. corporate tax. Dan Jacobson with the California Public Interest Research Group applauds the state treasurer's move, but he thinks the state could do more for divestment campaigns.
That California should put a screen on the kinds of companies it invests in. And there should really be two screens on that. We think that the first one should deal with accounting practices and accounting reform. So we should never be investing in companies that have both the same accountant and the same people as consultants. We think that we should only be investing in companies where the CEO is clearly disclosing their pay package. But in addition to that, we think there should be a secondary screen, which is the state of California investing in companies that are going to benefit California in the long term? Is this a company that can bring more jobs to the state of California? Is this a company that's providing clean technologies for California?
So far, the state of California has dropped only one business from its investment pool, the industrial manufacturer Ingersoll Rand Corporation, whose headquarters are in Bermuda. However, two of California's largest investors, both retirement funds for state workers and teachers, have $752 million invested in expatriating companies. State Treasurer Angelides sits on the boards of both investment funds and is recommending that they follow the state's lead. Stacy Reeser, with the California Teachers Retirement System, says the board will vote on the treasurer's proposals, and she says her organization already divested from some expatriating companies so to protect the investor.
We have been voting against incorporating into Bermuda, and the reason for that is that we feel that the shareholder protections, we're not sure that they would be the same in Bermuda as they are here in the United States.
Neither Tyco, Stanley Works, or Ingersoll Rand Corporation returned phone calls for this story. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jeserich in Sacramento.
This coming Saturday, the recently elected Bolivian Congress will decide who the country's next president will be. In a surprising June 30 presidential election result, Reyes candidate Sanchez de Lozada failed to win the presidency outright because he did not get 50% of the popular vote, instead sharing the votes with Indian coca farmer Evo Morales. In a move likely to clinch him the presidency, Lozada today reached an agreement with another former president, leftist Jaime Paz Zamora, that will assure enough votes in the 157-member Congress to be elected. The accord for Bolivia between Sanchez de Lozada's nationalist revolutionary movement and Paz Zamora's leftist revolutionary movement gives the future government a strong majority. Sanchez de Lozada, who grew up in the United States, made his fortune through mining interests. This alliance comes as the U.S. Department of State issued a warning this week telling its citizens there is a possibility of, quote, acts of violence directed against public buildings such as government and police buildings throughout Bolivia. The U.S. opposed Cocofama Morales' candidacy, with Otto Reich, the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for the Western Hemisphere Affairs, saying this month that the inclusion of Morales in a government coalition could endanger millions of dollars in aid to Bolivia. Morales has led many protests against an unpopular U.S.-led program to eradicate coca, which Indians use as a remedy for altitude sickness and hunger. Yvonne Zimmerman has more from Bolivia.
For the first time ever, indigenous peoples and anti-neoliberal movements will be represented in parliament as a significant force. Until now, in that country split between the modern and rich Bolivia of whites and the poor Bolivia of indigenous people, the latter have basically been excluded from politics. Over the past years, however, indigenous movements have been growing steadily. Evo Morales, leader of Bolivian farmers, played a prominent role in their mobilizations. He called on farmers to resist against so-called plant dignity, with which the Bolivian government plans to destroy all coca plants. Evo Morales proposes the industrial use of the coca leaf for medicine, instead of eradication of coca plants, which are many farmers' only income. A few days before the elections, U.S. Ambassador Manuel Rocha intervened, threatening with a cut of financial support from the United States in case Evo Morales got elected president. In spite of this intervention, however, the coca farmers' president got a lot of support. Why did the U.S. Embassy see Evo Morales as a danger? The president of the coca farmers and the political party, Movement Towards Socialism, explains his party's program, saying that it is based on an anti-neoliberal and anti-capitalist position. One major point is, says Morales, not only to stop neoliberal politics, but to reverse it.
Of course, we do have a program, and it's based on the movement's proposals. It's in the context of an anti-neoliberal and anti-capitalist position. It's about the refounding of the country. We want to finish with the rule of political mafia. They don't rule, they negotiate the country. On top, the rich have been benefiting for years from the country's money, and now it's the poor that will benefit. The neoliberal system was a failure, and now it's the poor people's turn.
The significance of the recent elections is that for the first time since the introduction of neoliberal politics in Bolivia 17 years ago, the selling of state companies and natural resources to private enterprises will be criticized within parliament. As Bolivian sociologist Alvaro Garcia explains, previously marginalized sectors of society are now entering politics with a new discourse, focusing on the dignity of indigenous peoples and on a new economy.
The center of the new discourse is the incorporation of indigenous people in the political system. The dignity of previously marginalized peoples, the transformation of the economy, which is based on free trade, into one that is concerned with the satisfaction of the basic needs of the people.
The rise of social movements and of Evo Morales is seen as a victory by some, while it worries others. According to third voted candidate Manfred Reyes Villa, U.S. Ambassador Rocha asked him to vote for Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada in the coming final elections in order to prevent Evo Morales' presidency. Even if not all of the conservative political parties support Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada, the ex-president is most likely to become future president, with just a slim majority. Evo Morales emphasizes the importance of other movement support within and without the country. Even if conservative forces are trying to isolate the newly expressed forces, according to sociologist Alvaro Garcia, social movements are the winners of the recent elections in any case. The victory, he says, is on a moral level.
Moralmente ha derrumbado el sistema de creencias y de certidumbre.
Morally, the system of beliefs and certainties, which the elites had, broke down in the recent elections. Apart from the fact that the right-wing conservatives will form the new government and will form a majority, morally, they are destroyed. They show themselves as a decadent, weak force, while social and indigenous movements are vital, creative, and still ascending.
The next weeks in Bolivia will be decisive for the future years. The Congress will decide on the new president, on the one hand, and indigenous and social movements, on the other, will have to decide if they want to join their forces. So far, there have been divisions between them. But in the light of conservatives joining forces, says Alvaro Garcia, a coordination of social and indigenous movements might be the only way. Yvonne Zimmerman, Cochabamba, Bolivia.
As wildfires continue to burn across the West, a debate is raging on forest management and logging. As timber lobbyists are trying to use the fires as an excuse to log more of the forest, the Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle is trying to push through legislation that will allow logging on roadless areas in his home state of South Dakota. Free Speech Radio News' Charles Michael Ray has the story.
A pair of firefighters rake dirt and spray water onto a cackling bed of embers that is flaring up on a control line in South Dakota. The brunt of the blaze has just blown through this area, leaving a stand of blackened and smoldering pine trees. The ridge above has been turned to a fine gray ash, but a home just below this slope remains intact. Fire crews were able to save this one, but hundreds of other homes have been lost in this year's wildfires. Tens of thousands of people have been evacuated, and more than 4 million acres have burned. That's four times the average, and the peak season hasn't even begun. Timber lobbies and Forest Service officials have been quick to blame the intensity of this fire season on forest management practices that they say have allowed too many trees to grow in the West. Riding on public fears, pro-timbering groups in areas across the West have made a large push to increase logging on the forest, a move they say will reduce fire intensity. But the assumption that more thinning will reduce fire danger is not necessarily true. Eric Bonds with Biodiversity Associates cites several fires, including the massive Jasper Fire of 2000 in South Dakota, that burned a huge number of acres on a heavily logged area.
So if logging could reduce fire risk, the Jasper Fire area would have been one of the most fireproof places in the entire world. But instead, in 2000, the area became the largest recorded fire in Black Hills history. So logging really has never been shown to be an effective way of protecting people's lives and property or reducing fire risk.
Environmental groups say the best and really only way to protect homes is to fireproof the area directly around them, not cut trees in remote wilderness areas. But they say this message hasn't reached many in Congress, who continue to call for more logging in protected areas. The Senate Majority Leader, Tom Daschle, recently pushed through a rider on a military spending bill that will allow immediate logging on two roadless areas in his home state. Daschle says the areas in the Black Hills of South Dakota need to be thinned of trees to reduce fire danger.
Basically, it will allow the Forest Service to begin thinning in Beaver Park and Norbeck immediately, and we can look to the future with a lot more confidence about Forest Service management.
The areas that Daschle's bill would log represent some of the last old-growth pine stands in South Dakota. One of them is a designated wilderness. The other has never been logged. Both of these sites lie in the 2% of the Black Hills that remain roadless. Jeff Kessler, conservation director with Biodiversity Associates, says his group is considering taking this issue to court.
We believe right now that it is a heinous bill from an ecological standpoint, from a safety standpoint, and from a rule of law and democracy standpoint. This undoes or negates several very important environmental protection and public participation laws.
While the debate over forest management rages on, all sides seem to agree that the hot, dry weather this summer is the biggest factor leading to the huge fires. Climatologists say the extra dry conditions this year have been exacerbated by global warming. Current models predict that the center of North America will get warmer and drier as the greenhouse effect continues. Some scientists even predict that the extra dry conditions could continue for another few summers. So there is a possibility that this problem will get worse before it gets better. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations KPFA in Berkeley and WBAI in New York City, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. I'm Deepa Fernandez.